This line of guns represents a position of Company I of the 1st U.S. Artillery. This was a regular Army battery under the command of Captain James B. Ricketts. They deployed here about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on July 21st, 1861. And this is about as far as they got that day. In fact, this is about as far as the whole Union Army got. There's a lot of fighting swirling around Ricketts' guns by late in the afternoon. But to understand what happened to this battery, not to mention the whole Union Army, you really need to understand some of the events that brought these guns to this position. It's also useful to understand the frame of mind the Union Army was in at the time. Now, when the Union Army left their camps around Washington on the afternoon of July 16th, they were very optimistic and quite confident in victory, and perhaps with good reason. They were one of the best equipped armies ever put in the field. Some of the troops had the brand new rifle muskets, far superior to the old smoothbore muskets. Many of the batteries had these brand new 10-pounder Parrott rifles. These guns were state-of-the-art weapons in 1861, quite capable of throwing a 10-pound projectile well over a mile quite accurately. If you have guns that have greater range and accuracy than those of the enemy, you're likely to enjoy a tactical advantage on the battlefield. But not only did the Union Army expect to outgun the Confederates here, they also expected to overwhelm them with some 35,000 men. This was the largest army that had ever been assembled in this country up to that point in time. So no doubt many of these Union troops felt somewhat invincible as they marched in this direction. Well, as the Union Army approached, Confederate forces fell back to this side of a stream called Bull Run. Now, Bull Run's about a mile off to our east. You can't see it from here. If you haven't already done so today, we encourage you to take a ride down to the Stone Bridge where the old Warrenton Turnpike used to cross Bull Run. There you'll discover that Bull Run is not a very significant stream. It's not very wide, it's not very deep. In fact, this time of year you can wade across Bull Run in any number of places and not get much more than your knees wet. But this is where the Confederates under General P.G.T. Beauregard decided to draw their line and make their stand to defend the railroad junction, which is about 5 miles off to our south. Now, even though Bull Run is not that large a stream, it does have very steep banks, either on one or both sides. Those steep banks would limit the places where the Union Army could actually get across, especially with their artillery. And this certainly worked to the advantage of the Confederates. All General Beauregard had to do was to concentrate his troops at the various fords that were scattered between the Stone Bridge to our east and the railroad bridge 8 miles downstream. He could then put his troops where they were needed the most and still be able to spread his army over a very wide front in order to protect Manassas Junction. Well, on the 18th of July, after a very cautious march from Washington, Union forces arrived at Centerville. And having met little or no resistance up to that point in time, the leading division under General Daniel Tyler was given orders to make a reconnaissance down the road toward Manassas. Now, the road between Centerville and Manassas crossed Bull Run at a place called Blackburn's Ford. It's about 4 or 4.5 miles to our southeast. As these Union troops approached Blackburn's Ford, they encountered very stiff resistance from a brigade of Confederates under General James Longstreet. In the resulting skirmish, the Union Army got a bloody nose for all their effort, and they retreated back to Centerville to lick their wounds. The fighting that day proved to General Irvin McDowell, the Union Army's overall commander, that the Confederates were ready, willing, and able to put up a strong defense along this little stream. Now, General McDowell was a regular Army officer, and like many in the regular Army, he did not have a whole lot of confidence in the volunteers and militia that made up the bulk of his force. These troops were, by and large, very inexperienced. Very few had ever been in combat before, and that included a large percentage of the militia officers leading the various militia regiments. In fact, many of these militia officers were no more than politicians in uniform who could barely march their men in a straight line on the parade ground, let alone on the battlefield under fire. And many of the troops were not fully trained either. A good number, in fact, had never even fired their muskets up to this point in time. And being citizen soldiers, there was a certain lack of discipline among them. So General McDowell had some rather strong reservations about this whole campaign right from the very start. But at the same time, there was a sense of urgency to fight a battle. Most of these troops had enlisted back in April, right after the fall of Fort Sumter, for a term of 90 days. And by the end of July, most of these troops would pack up and go home. So there was a sense of urgency to march this army into Virginia, fight a big battle, and hopefully win the war before his army would cease to exist. Well, General McDowell wisely decided not to force the issue along the banks of Bull Run, where he found the Confederates in relatively strong positions. Instead, he decided the most prudent thing to do would be to try to maneuver around the Confederate lines with his inexperienced troops. Well, it took 2 more days before General McDowell found a suitable place to get across Bull Run. Ultimately, his scouts discovered an unguarded ford 2 miles upstream from the Stone Bridge, off to the north here at a place called Sudley Springs. General McDowell made his plans accordingly. Well, the First Battle of Bull Run has been described as one of the best-planned battles of the entire Civil War. A diversionary attack would be made off to the east here in the vicinity of the Stone Bridge. General Tyler's troops would try to occupy the attention of the Confederates over there, while two Union divisions, about 15,000 men, would circle around to the north, cross Bull Run at Sudley Springs, and hopefully get behind General Beauregard's lines. For this plan to succeed, General McDowell needed the element of surprise. To achieve surprise, it was important to get all these troops into position under cover of darkness before dawn on July 21st. Well, General Tyler's troops were in position more or less on schedule over there by the Stone Bridge, and as soon as it got light enough to see, they opened fire and proceeded to make a lot of noise and attract a lot of attention, just as they were supposed to do. But those 15,000 Union troops marching around to Sudley Springs, due to the extra distance involved, the poor condition of the roads they were using, not to mention the fact that there was a lot of, lack of discipline on the line of march, these Union troops were some 3 hours late getting to where they were supposed to be. They did not begin to cross Bull Run until 9:30 that morning, long after the sun was high in the sky. Long after the Confederates had noticed some very heavy dust clouds off here on the northern horizon, which told them everything they needed to know about General McDowell's intentions. Among the first Confederates to notice those dust clouds was Captain E.P. Alexander, General Beauregard's signal officer. That morning, Captain Alexander was about 7.5 miles to the southeast of us, down behind the Confederate right flank at Union Mills. But from his signal station on a fairly good-sized hill, he could plainly see those dust clouds off to the north. And even though he was somewhat distant from the scene of action, he was still in a position to do something about it. From his signal station down there on the Confederate right flank, he could easily communicate with the Confederate left flank with the signal flags. And it was shortly before 9 o'clock that morning when he sent a warning to Colonel Nathan Evans, who commanded the Confederate forces over here by the Stone Bridge, there was danger off to the north. Now, Colonel Evans acted very decisively. He left two companies immediately along Bull Run to guard the bridge, left two more companies in rear of the Stone Bridge in reserve, and then he moved the rest of his small brigade, about 900 men, put them in position just over there on that opposite hillside across the valley. That's known as Matthews Hill. And there he formed a line of battle, expecting to intercept this Union flanking column marching down the road from Sudley Springs. Well, it was a little bit after 10 o'clock that morning when the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteer Infantry, leading the Union advance, came down the Sudley Road and found themselves confronted by these Confederates under Colonel Evans. From the very beginning, the Confederates found themselves very much outnumbered and very much outgunned. But not only did the Confederates stand their ground, they attacked rather aggressively. And this caused some confusion among the Union ranks. It certainly brought the Union column to a grinding halt, and this had the desired effect. It bought time for General Beauregard to send reinforcements in this direction. And there were plenty of reinforcements to be had. Just a day earlier, General Joseph E. Johnston had arrived here in Manassas with most of his troops from the Shenandoah Valley, with the help of the Manassas Gap Railroad. By 11 o'clock that morning, the first of these reinforcements from the Army of the Shenandoah began to arrive, and they moved forward to support Colonel Evans in his beleaguered position on Matthews Hill. But even with these initial reinforcements, the Confederates were hard-pressed. The Union Army was also getting stronger and stronger as the morning wore on, as more of these 15,000 Union troops came down the Sudley Road and deployed out into their lines of battle. By late morning, the Union Army had 20 pieces of artillery lining that opposite ridge across the valley, Ricketts' battery included. And they were pounding the Confederate positions. The Confederates were suffering very severe casualties. And by 12 o'clock noon, the Union lines had grown to such an extent that they were beginning to overlap the flanks of the Confederate lines. Well, having suffered very heavy casualties and with the Union Army closing in around them, the Confederates really had little choice except to fall back. And they did so in great haste, and in great disorder. After fleeing through the valley at the bottom of the hill here, they came over the top of Henry Hill between the Henry Farm and the Robinson Farm on the far side of the field here. And many of these Confederates just disappeared into the wooded ravines beyond. By 12:30 that day, it looked as though the battle was all over. It seemed like the whole Confederate army was in full retreat. They did not anticipate much further resistance. General McDowell was seen riding across the front of his lines, waving his hat, yelling, "Victory is ours!" And no doubt many Union troops were ready to break out the champagne right then and there and start celebrating the end of the war. McDowell, however, did not pursue the Confederates any great distance. In fact, as soon as his army reached the Warrenton Turnpike down here in the valley, just out of our view, he essentially called time out and proceeded to regroup his numbers. It was 1:30 that afternoon before General McDowell was ready to renew the offensive. In the meantime, there had been a rather quiet lull in the fighting. But it was around 1:30 that Captain Ricketts got his orders to advance his battery to where we are now, in pursuit of what was thought to be a retreating enemy. Now, actually, there were two Union batteries ordered up here to Henry Hill. The other battery being Company D of the 5th U.S. Artillery under Captain Charles Griffin. Griffin would eventually move his five guns into position just on the far side of the Henry House down here. It's well to note that both of these artillery officers were somewhat reluctant to advance their batteries to this location. Being regular army, they too had very little confidence in the volunteers and militia to support them in this forward position. And sure enough, after taking position up here, these artillerymen found themselves the only Union troops up here. All the volunteers and militia were lagging well behind and would take some time to get up here. In the meantime, instead of finding themselves chasing a retreating enemy, these batteries were confronted by a line of Confederate artillery no more than 300 yards away on the other side of this field. The Confederate guns quickly got the range. Their shot and shell bursting overhead was raining lead and iron in all directions over here, and it wasn't long after taking this position that Captain Ricketts found himself committed to this spot. He couldn't move these guns if he wanted to, owing to the losses among his horses back here by the limbers and caissons. And it was a good 20 or 30 minutes before the 1st Union Infantry would finally make their way up the hill to support this battery. Now, the 1st Union Infantry Regiment to arrive proved to be the 11th New York Volunteer Infantry, better known as the Fire Zouaves. These men were all firemen from New York City. And as their name implied, they were wearing a very colorful, rather distinctive Zouave uniform. I would hasten to add, they were not wearing their complete Zouave uniform that day. It was a very warm, rather oppressive July day. Very little wind at all to speak of. It was warm even before the sun came up, so the Zouaves had collectively decided not to wear their blue wool jackets into battle, which no doubt made them somewhat more comfortable in the weather, but at the same time, that left them wearing their bright red fireman shirts for all to see. As they marched up through Mrs. Henry's cornfield down here, they looked like they were going on parade up Broadway in their lovely line formation. And they eventually maneuvered around to the right flank of Captain Ricketts' guns, more or less where the parking lot is today. And of course, as soon as they gained the top of this hill, they certainly drew their fair share of fire from the Confederates. They certainly became a target of opportunity. And after trading one or two volleys with the enemy, many of these Zouaves evidently decided it might not be a good idea to be standing up here on top of this hill in a line formation wearing a red shirt. Many indeed decided at this point to take cover. Many found cover down behind the fence along the Sudley Road, which proved to be a very good sheltered position for them. If you drive down the Sudley Road today, you'll notice how steep the embankments are and how sheltered it actually was. Captain Ricketts, seeing the situation deteriorate up here, however, decided to chase after these Zouaves. He finally got down to the road and had to plead with the Zouaves to come back up the hill to save his guns, which were being cut to pieces. But the Zouaves, who had already suffered the loss of their colonel, did not seem inclined to take any orders from a captain of artillery. They seemed more intent upon holding that position down there along the roadside, and they weren't about to budge for anybody. Well, actually, about half an hour later, they would make an exception for two companies of the 1st Virginia Cavalry, led by Colonel Jeb Stuart, which suddenly appeared over here along the woods on the road, and Stuart's cavalry immediately charged this mass of fire Zouaves. And even though the Zouaves didn't suffer that many casualties by the cavalry, they certainly were scattered all over the map. And many fled in complete terror and panic down the Sudley Road into the ranks of the 14th Brooklyn, the 1st Minnesota, the Battalion of Marines, among other Union regiments that were moving up the hill. It caused a great deal of chaos and confusion down here behind the Union lines, and it left Captain Ricketts' guns here on top of the hill, very much alone, very much exposed, extremely vulnerable to attack. Now, before we venture across the field, I think it's worthy to note that there have been some subtle changes in the appearance of the battlefield. At the time of the war, this area was not a wide-open manicured lawn. In fact, this part of the Henry Farm was an old abandoned pasture. It had not been grazed or cultivated for a number of years. The grass in July gets to be about waist high, much the way you see it over on the far side of the field. And in addition to the tall grass, because the area had not been grazed or tilled, there were also quite a few small scattered pines and cedars that had taken seed out here. Now, most of these trees were still very young seedlings. This red cedar over here perhaps was no taller than you or me at the time. So the area was still generally open. But at the same time, it was a lot more overgrown than what you see today. Hold that thought. Afterwards, a Union officer testified before Congress that the remarkable thing about this battle was the enemy kept themselves well covered. Indeed, they were very much masked by the vegetation. And that was very much a problem for the gunners here on this battery. These guns might have great range and accuracy, but they're still direct fire weapons. You have to see your target if you want to hit it. And all these gunners over here could see, really, was smoke billowing from above the grass on the other side of the hill. They really couldn't see the individual guns very plainly. And so returning fire proved to be rather difficult for Captain Ricketts' gunners. Well, from here we're going to wander over to the Jackson Monument out there in the middle of the field, and we'll take a look at things from a slightly different angle and hopefully give you some idea of what the Union Army was actually up against.